Welcome to Newsworthy with Norrisworthy. Get ready for some awesome.
Welcome back to the show, friends. Today we have returning to the show, Barbara Brown Taylor. We'll talk a little bit more about her book, Learning to Walk in the Dark, a book that has become a New York Times bestseller. We also talk a little bit about her time on Oprah and who she would choose to play herself in a movie. We had one little hiccup. I've interviewed people from far and distant countries such as Australia and England and Colorado, and I've never messed up the time zone thing until today, and I messed it up in a state that I used to actually live in. I spent the summer in Georgia one time, yet it did not prevent me from getting the time zone messed up. So we start this interview. I'm kind of in a rush because I'm running late, and Barbara was gracious enough to start the conversation, even though we were a few minutes behind schedule because of my scheduling snafu. And so you'll hear me be a little bit nervous up front, but it turns out to be a good interview, as one would expect when you're talking to Barbara Brown Taylor. So here it is.
Okay. Today I'm feeling kind of mellow, so I'll probably just let you make me laugh.
Okay. Well, that's a fair deal. Now, I had something terrible happen to me at church a couple weeks ago. I was gone, and my small group was going through their discussion, and I had a Barbara Brown Taylor quote in there, and they read it while I was not leading my small group. I was out of town, and someone said, "I don't know who Barbara Brown Taylor is." And so I feel like the right response was, I told them to leave the church, and I said they weren't welcome anymore. Is that the right response?
Oh, no, I love being a cult classic. I like to be hard to find. That suits me well.
Well,
but I appreciate your loyalty. Thank you.
Well, I even gave him a copy of the book Leaving Church as a kind of innuendo that, hey, you're going to have to leave the church, but you get the book as a free parting gift.
See, it's proof you're a Christian.
Exactly. Now, Barbara, I saw that you were on Oprah just a couple weeks ago. How was that?
I was. Well, I taped it in August, so that gave me time to calm down. I don't get any TV connection where I live, so I just am coasting on what other people tell me, that it went all right. So I'm happy about that.
So you didn't actually get to watch it yourself?
No, I don't really like that. I can't even look at myself in a mirror at the gym, so I think it's better not to watch. But I did it because I wanted to meet her, and I loved meeting her. It's probably not a surprise, but she's the real deal. She was gracious and warm and hospitable and had done her homework and asked great questions, and she had better shoes than I did, but that was my only complaint, really.
Did you get to talk to her much before or after?
No, she has a lot of shows to produce every single day, so she let me in the door. I couldn't get in. She let me in. She took me to the green room, and then she came and got me and took me to a quiet soundstage. We had no live audience. It was a taped show, which made it very relaxing. It was just like a conversation with her that they edited later for public use.
Oh, that's great. That's great. So did you prefer being in front of an empty soundstage instead of being with a live audience?
Oh, I don't like cameras at all. As long as I have you on, you know, a podcast, I'm almost ready to quit going places because people tweet and twist and toot and post and without permission, and it's incredibly invasive. So radio and what you and I are doing right now is a far more warm medium for me than anything having to do with cameras. So no, I would not have done the show with her if there had been a live audience.
I'm assuming you've had some bad experiences with people taking your stuff out of context.
Oh, I just feel invaded. You know, I feel like, but I guess because I was drawn to pastoral life, relationships are important to me. Mm-hmm. Context important to me, that when you hear a sermon, you hear it with somebody sitting to the left of you and to the right of you, and you know what kind of weather it is outside the windows. And, you know, I'm willing to have a sermon tape for people who are shut-ins, but somehow taking words out of context just seems to me like a robbery of the relationship. So I'm old-fashioned in that way. I still love to be free in a room with the people who've chosen to be there to speak with them in some intimacy that it's between us. But these days, that's not really possible anymore. So I miss that. I miss the closeness and the sense that we made some effort to be there together. And so what we're saying is between us. And they can repeat it in their own words, but mm-hmm. it's not somehow just leaking out all the time to other people in little snippets out of context.
Do you ever feel like there is like a responsibility as someone who's a very gifted communicator, a great thinker, that, you know, your message could get out to more people if you were out in, you know, and created a larger platform? Do you ever feel like that, like you have a responsibility to be in a bigger presence?
You know, if I were Galileo, maybe, or Sigmund Freud, but no, there are plenty of other people saying what I'm saying. This is not a unique voice, not a unique message. So no, I don't feel that responsibility.
You don't, so you don't see yourself as having a unique voice? You see other people saying the same things? That seems
kind of... Well, everybody has a unique voice, but uh-huh. I mean, there are plenty of people who are guessing, you know, about what's going on with the spirit and the church and the world, and they are articulate. And furthermore, there's some of them aching to get their messages out, aching. And I so want to clear the way for them to do that because I have no appetite for that life.
Well, that's going to be kind of hard, but like when like all your books make it to the New York Times bestseller list, it seems like, and Oprah wants to talk to you, and you have, mm-hmm. you know, Time Magazine calling you one of their 100 most influential people. It seems like mm-hmm. you get all these things that so many other people want to have, but you have no interest with them.
No, the books will speak for themselves. I mean, the books are out there. I'm happy to write books because people can read those books in the middle of the night or while they're waiting in a line at a grocery store. They can read the books anywhere. But there are people in the world who want to be out there, and there are, I mean, people who don't. So yeah. We'll change the subject soon.
Yeah, fair enough. Well, you say you said on Oprah something that kind of touched on previously in some of your writing, but you make the comment that your life isn't conducive for friendship. Are you referring to your life as a pastor?
Oh, no. I'm talking about working a full-time job as mm-hmm. a college professor and then writing books, which is a pretty full-time job, and then keeping up a speaking and travel schedule, which is a pretty full-time job, and then trying to keep up with an 86-year-old mom whose power of attorney I am, and grandchildren and nephews, which is a pretty full-time job. So yeah. Once I've drawn those important circles of vocation and family, there's very little time left for friends.
Oh, well, I'm glad that you made time for me to be friends with you today while we're talking. Okay, so I've heard you say this, and I think this was in the most recent book, but you say that an introverted romantic with a touch of obsessive compulsive disorder does not make the best pastor.
Yeah. So, don't you think that's true?
Well, I don't know. You're Barbara Brown Taylor. I can't tell you that. Well, what do you think is like the best pastor then? What is the personality that would be most conducive for the pastoral life?
You know, it doesn't really matter what I think, because, I mean, most of the measures show that lots and lots of introverts are drawn to parish ministry.
Yeah.
And I think we're drawn to the intimate, relational parts of it. We're drawn to the illusion that it's going to involve a lot of prayer and reading. And so there are a lot of introverts in parish ministry, but the people I see survive best are people who thrive on human company. They absolutely gain energy from being with numbers of people. And for them, it's a plus and not a minus to get up and move into a crowd of people. And that seems like a perfect match, you know, in most parishes I know about. So it's hard to see the drawbacks of being an extrovert.
Yeah, well,
it's easy to see the drawbacks of being an introvert. Yeah.
If you're an introvert, you like studying, you like being in your office by yourself, you like being with your books, and to write a sermon, what do you prescribe for the amount of hours to put into that? 15, 20, something
a
like
lot.
That?
But we'll back up to one thing. The other thing I think is extroverts, we listen exquisitely. I mean, you put us in a room with one other person who has a problem mm-hmm. or one other person who's ill, and I think we do that extremely well. What's really hard then is to make the transition and go back to a committee meeting or proofreading the bulletin. So I see it as a changing gears kind of thing, too, that it's introversion goes pretty deep, and so it's more difficult to change gears quickly. Now, the sermon question is tainted by my love of writing sermons, which means I'm never in a hurry.
Yeah.
And when I'm in a hurry, I'm miserable. So writing a sermon, working on a sermon, reading about a sermon, daydreaming about a sermon, my favorite thing to do. So I do conform to the sort of 19th century standard of an hour's work for every minute in the pulpit. So 20 minutes in the pulpit, about 20 hours.
Wow. Yeah. Well, that's what I was told when I was in grad school, possibly because I was reading one of your books or something that you had said, but I completely agree with that. And so if you're putting 20 hours in, it's kind of hard to find the time to be with everyone that you want to be with if you have to allocate that much time by yourself doing your sermon writing.
If I get to allocate that much time.
Yeah, exactly.
Because that 20 hours includes daydreaming and sleeping and walking and prayer and study. It's not a, you know, that's not 20 hours pecking at a computer.
Yeah.
That's 20 hours of incubation and illumination and preparation, and it's got a lot of stages to it, and they don't have to be done all at once. They could be done walking around. But I did, like lots of other people, suffer from the expectation of omnicompetence, that I could go to sleep on a Saturday night and wake up with a full-fledged, beautiful sermon on Sunday, and that it would take no time to prepare it, and that I would be gifted at all things. These are my own expectations as much as anybody else's. But I think parish ministry more and more is picking up an awful lot of pieces the culture has dropped, all the way from medical care. Look at the rise of parish nurses, some ways in which I think many clergy are dealing with psychiatric emergencies we're not trained or equipped to deal with. Look at the disappearance of third places between work and home, whether that was a corner drugstore or a pickup softball game. I think shopping malls maybe fill that purpose for us now, but I think the more church budgets shrink, clergy are expected to step in and be community organizers and fundraising experts, pastoral counselors, good teachers. The list becomes quite overwhelming, and I don't know any answer to that right now, except perhaps the ministry of the laity, that we revisit that as often as we're able to talk about what it is to be a pastor in community, but not pastor of the community, the only one.
Hmm. Do you think that's one of the same experiences people at the large churches are experiencing, in the same way that, you know, you're describing a, you know, a small parish ministry in which the pastor is doing everything? Do you think that's something that that is also going to be a shift that you see at the mega churches as well, or like the larger churches, like maybe the one you're part of in Atlanta?
Yeah, and I only have two churches to compare, remember, and the one in Atlanta was not mega. What I noticed there was a wonderful gift of being able to listen to other clergy preach. You know, we could listen to one another and learn from one another. I always thought that was possible even when I was a solo pastor. If I would get serious about a preaching guild in the parish of gifted public speakers who would be willing to work together, be licensed by the bishop, and, you know, become, again, a group of voices so that the congregation could hear men and women, older and younger, people representing a lot of different walks of life.
Yeah.
What I noticed, though, even in a big downtown parish, was when people were in the hospital, they wanted to see the main guy. They didn't want to see an assistant. They didn't want to see an associate, and they sure didn't want to see a loving layperson. They wanted the big guy there.
Why do you think that is? Why do they want the big guy?
Well, I either have got an idea that he has mojo, he has special mojo, or I want to know I matter that much.
Hmm.
That however busy he is, I am more important than, you know, proofreading the bulletin or what, or his committee meeting. So I don't know. You'd have to ask the person who would like that kind of visit. But I did find often I was a placeholder when I would show up until the senior pastor could get there. So whatever that's about, it's an interesting comment on the way I think a lot of us speak of the ministry of the laity, but need to think about whether we really mean it or not.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Now, one of the things I've picked up on listening to you is an example you just did right there. Well, where you say, I can't answer for them. You have to ask them. And I've heard you say before when talking about the full sun Christianity versus solar Christianity that, you know, who am I to speak about that and their experience? Let them have that. Where you don't want to, like, speak for everyone, and you have this humility in which you don't want to answer for everyone's situation. Is that something that you've developed over the years, or is that something that you've always kind of had as an innate humility in that you didn't want to, you know, have your experience and your opinions being the only one that really mattered?
You're so nice to call it humility. I just don't want to lie. And it seems to me that any time I go for a generality, what's the difference between a generality and a stereotype? I've sure learned that teaching world religions.
Yeah.
That if I stand up and spend 5 days teaching on Buddhism, students go out thinking all Buddhists do X, Y, and Z. And it's been interesting this term to switch it around and teach through case studies that highlight the incredible diversity within the world traditions. But I find students are very confused by that. They want great big handles that will reliably describe people who will not step outside the container they have been given for who they are. So there are a lot of ways in which I have listened to women speak about women's experience, or listened to African Americans speak about Black experience, or Asians, for heaven's sake, speak about Asian experience. Are we talking about Korean or Chinese or Laotian or Cambodian? It just seems to me there's a great deal more particularity to truth than some of us are comfortable with. But the more I can honor that by saying what you said, I just say, it seems, it's frustrating. It's frustrating to me, and it's sure frustrating to my listener. But I guess I could go ahead and speak generality so people could say yes, but I usually beat them to the yes, buts. I know most of the exceptions.
Well, you've done well with that. But in all seriousness, it does seem that in America, one of the things that seems to sell really well is certainty. And if you can say, this is exactly what it is, there's no doubt about it, it's just completely black and white, my words are exactly true, and if you listen to me, I will be the dispenser of all wisdom, so just listen to me, buy what I'm selling, pick up what I'm putting down, and you'll be great. But you don't seem to do that. You seem to be okay with, this is just my opinion of it, this is just my take on it.
Oh, you know, when I was going on Oprah, I was just suffering the torments of the damned, because I looked at other people on her show, and they all had their three things, or their five techniques, or their seven strategies.
Yeah.
I called my husband. I said, Ed, what's my message? Quick, I need to know my message before tomorrow. And he said, your message is, there's definitely a message, but people have to find it for themselves.
Thanks,
and I thought, oh, they're going to love that.
Yeah, well, I saw that she's got Richard Rohr coming up in a couple weeks. I think
that, he's terrific.
Yeah, he's great. He's on the show a couple weeks ago, and he actually stopped the interview and said, Luke, you're very cute at one point after I asked the question. So I hope he doesn't do that to Oprah. Do you think he will?
I don't know, and I won't be tuning in, obviously, though I may be able to watch it later on a computer.
Okay, but seriously, you didn't watch – you were on Oprah. They had a whole set, you know, an hour thing on you. You haven't tuned in for one bit of that.
Look, I was in church. It was 11 o'clock on a Sunday morning. I was at church.
I was too, but it's on the internet. You can just Google Oprah BBT, and there the whole thing is.
Believe me, you enjoyed it much more than I would have.
Was it really just nerve-wracking for you to, like, watch yourself?
Completely, utterly nerve-wracking. I mean, think about it. I mean, I didn't even tag the numbers of viewers, but suppose you say a stupid thing. Not only is the stupid thing heard by very many people, but the stupid thing is preserved for posterity. It'll play in repeating links forever and ever. No, anybody with an ounce of self-consciousness or self-doubt is going to find that excruciating. Or they've matured to the point I still aspire to mature to, which is, whatever, did my best, move on.
Okay, so is it gonna nag you? Is it going to, like, really just stay with you, thinking about maybe one of the comments that got away from you?
No. I already have new things to be nervous about.
So you have enough things to be nervous about? Is that what you said?
I have new things every day, yeah. That was last August. I'm already on to new things. I just agreed to write an article. It's a series Time is going to put out on questions Jesus asked. And I asked for the one about, why are you anxious? I thought that was my question.
Okay, so what are you going to say about the question?
You have to wait, read the book. But I do think there's room for, I'm slowly recruiting a small group of friends. They're all women, and we're gonna start a special kind of spirituality we're going to call neurotic spirituality.
Oh, that sounds interesting. Can you tease us just a little bit? I promise I'll buy the book. If you just give me a little bit about what neurotic looks like.
Oh, I just saw my very best friends. I hope we're people of faith. We sure have put in the time, and we just stay anxious. I mean, if you asked me to pray for you, I would say, Luke, I will absolutely worry about you, and that would be my form of prayer. So
does that count?
We're all trying.
Does that count, worrying instead of praying?
Well, I hope so. I worry about people all the time. That's sort of my form of prayer. I just worry about them. And it doesn't mean I don't believe God will care for them, but unfortunately I know that means God may care for them about 9 days after their funeral. So that's, you know, for those of us who like to be together on earth,
yeah,
that kind of providence isn't always the kind we want.
Yeah. Yeah, I would prefer if you could, like, give me, like, 3 tips to always getting my prayers answered. That would be really helpful.
And to be fair to some of those people you were talking about, the best ones, and they are bestsellers too, will say things like, try this. You know, here's something to try. Try this and see how it works for you. Because there are plenty of people on the bestseller list. Look at Brené Brown. I think she's a pretty lovely writer. Richard Rohr's been on. Hasn't he been on the bestseller list? At least some religious bestseller list.
He sold a lot of books. Yeah.
Yeah. And Rob Bell is out there, I think, asking a lot of good questions. So, you know, while I would love in my, generalizing way to say to you the only people who sell big books are the ones who peddle certainty, I also think there's some really gifted writers who are out there saying, I'm not sure, but I'm willing to put this in print in order to edge the discussion further.
Yeah.
And that's a great, great thing for people to be willing to do. I hope that's what I do with the books I write, is ask questions everybody's asking but perhaps had not yet put into words, say some stupid things people have always thought but have been afraid to say, and maybe take the conversation one step further, whether it's because readers disagree with me and let me know, or say, yes, but have you ever thought about, la, la, la.
Yeah.
Or they agree. It doesn't matter. It's just like you put the stuff out there to evolve the discussion.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I've heard you talk about preaching, and I think you're channeling Craddock here, but you talk about preaching. It's not telling people what they don't know, but you give words to what they already think or feel or something like that.
And that's pure Craddock. The direct quote is, people aren't waiting for you to tell them what they need to know. They're waiting for you to say what they want to say but don't know how.
Oh, that's a lot better than the way I botched it. How has that been something you've tried to live into? Is that something that you've obviously taken to your preaching but also with your writing? Or how does someone even do that?
Oh, you spend that 1 hour per minute thinking about what it is to be human and where you've run into the wall on being human and where you've been stung by other people who were perhaps meaning to be human but stepped all over you instead. And maybe you go through all the old familiar church disciplines, you know, of some coming to Jesus about that and some confession and some clarity and some new wind, some new breath, new confidence in new choices being possible. But to say what people have always wanted to say but have not known how means I have to know what those things are for me and be in some kind of regular conversation with people as different from me as possible so that I'm not just speaking to my little clique.
Yeah.
Of like-minded Christians, which I still do. I don't doubt that. But at least, you know, trying to widen the tent as much as possible.
So, one of the struggles that I wrestle with is sometimes I feel like I'm just preaching to myself. Like, I know my issues, and I know my baggage, and I know the brokenness that I have. And I'm always thinking about those things because that's my stuff. And I want to just talk to those things and live out of that, you know, be my own, you know, wounded healer, so to speak. And that's like the best way to talk about it. The other way to see it is that I'm just turning my sermons into like my therapeutic 30 minutes or something. How do you make sure that that's not what you're doing? I mean, you want to.
Well, first of all, gee, are you ever a normal human being? Because we all do that. I mean, everybody does that. And I think in some ways, rather than fight that, the very best thing you can do is recognize that. Pull out the last 30 sermons you preached. Figure out what your particularly beloved piece of the gospel is, and I'm putting my money on you going back through your own religious history and realizing that's the part of the gospel that hooked you. That's the net that caught you. Mm-hmm. And that's why it is so important to you. And the good news about that is it's, if it is truly part of the gospel, part of the good news, it's going to be incredibly valuable to some other people too.
Yeah.
I think if you stay in the vocation long, it's good at some point to wonder about other pieces of the gospel that are equally liberating to you or to other people, and to stay curious about those too. But good grief, I would think just clarity about the piece you love and why you love it. You know, why would you, I don't know if you're a partnered person, but why in the world would you decide that, darn, you went and partnered yourself to one person when you just keep waking up beside the same person every day? I assume that faithfulness to that's a good thing. So why wouldn't faithfulness to your facet of the diamond of the gospel also be a good thing?
Hmm. Well, first of all, I am very partnered. I've got a partner and three daughters. So
yeah, pretty stuck.
Yeah, we're very, very much stuck together. She's not going anywhere. And I don't, I can't do better, so I'm not going anywhere. But yeah, I get the metaphor. Like, that's, this is the part of the gospel that I'm married to, and it connects to me. And that makes sense. So you talk about some of Ken Wilber's stuff in your book about the transformation and translation. And so I like the idea of, okay, this is, you know, translating the world around me. So, you know, my life has more meaning and gives sense to kind of like my own brokenness. But like, that seems like the translation part, the comforting, consoling who I am. But the other part of the gospel is like the transformation that's got to not just comfort me, but it's got to dismantle me. And so how do I like live in that tension of, okay, I need to, you know, be married to this part that transforms me, but also, or excuse me, that soothes me, but also needs to let that go.
I can only tell you how I've done that. I mean, A, what I love about your quick summary there is you didn't make those opposed. They're not opposed. And if I understood Ken Wilber, what he was saying is they are both part of any living religion, that those are the two functions of religion: to translate the world for the self, comfort the self, and to transform the self or dismantle the self. And for myself, there are a couple of ways. One is all I have to really do is read the Gospels, and instead of only going back to read the parts I love, read it all and do my best not to domesticate the really awful, hard sayings about hating mother and father and selling all that you own and losing your life. And, you know, we could talk for another 3 hours about all of that. But it's a difficult thing to embrace the whole story and not just the parts that I love. But beyond my own sacred text, it helps enormously to, I'm beginning to have more and more books on the shelf of Bible study from communities around the world. And it's interesting, passages that are comforting to me where I live are not at all comforting to people who live in other parts of the world.
Really?
So that's been disorienting in the best possible way, to understand that the parable of the talents to someone in an economically corrupt society is just one more parable about the rich getting richer while the poor get poorer. And, you know, to read a peasant interpretation of that account is to hear that Jesus must have told that parable so the people hearing him would stand up and start yelling and saying, no, 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 you don't bury your one talent in the ground so that the guy with five, you know, can make 15. That it was a parable meant to cause uproar in the congregation, while my congregations just sit quietly and listen to it and say, oh, yes, my portfolio should be better invested so I can give more to the church. You know, so the disruptions are also there, I think, when you leave comfortable commentaries, interpretations, books, and conversation partners just to hear how things sound from another place.
Yeah, that makes
sense. That's not the full answer, but it's a start.
Well, that's a really good place to start. Why do you think it's so important? Is that why you think it's so important to have this, you know, wider community than just the people who look like you and have the same neuroses that you have, because you get a bigger picture?
Yeah, I mean, now that you mention it that way, isn't that interesting? It's that we have congregations of translation, right?
Yeah.
But wouldn't it be interesting if we also sought out some communities of transformation? You know, that we had both in our lives, because I do think, I mean, show me the parish that doesn't, you know, in which we're not challenging each other all the time, in which we're not dismantling each other all the time, but not usually over things that matter enough, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But that's an interesting idea. You know, what would it be like intentionally to love and cherish the communities of comfort, but also to seek out in different ways the communities that discomfort?
Yeah. How is it as a priest, pastor, that you get to experience transformation in a community? Because in some ways, it seems like there's that separation. And I love the story you tell. I think it's from Leaving Church about the pool party when you feel, I think you said you felt waterproof until like someone pushed you in the water. Now, first of all, if I was there, I would not have pushed you in the water, and I would have made sure no one else did. So, and I'm sorry. I'm just telling you that I would be your bodyguard. Okay. One of the services I offer as a friend. So, but as a pastor, like, there is this separation, and you talk about how beautiful it was that someone actually did push you in, and so that was a great thing that they treated you as normal. But, like, do you really get to experience that when you are the priest, the pastor who is supposed to be the one who says, "Thus said the Lord," every Sunday?
Oh, no. I mean, come on. You know this. You don't do that in the place that you're the 24/7 person. No.
Mm.
No, that comes from the Boy Scout troop you coach, or the water aerobics you teach on the side, or better yet, you know, for me, maybe when you leave town and go do something somewhere else where people say, "Your name's what? It's Barbara what?"
Mm-hmm.
It's important, I think, you know, to go places where your only credential is you're one more pair of able hands, and you're not known as the pastor. No, I don't seek that in churches. You know, classrooms are different. Classrooms don't self-select in the same way that churches do. Students are in class because they have to have that course to graduate, and that means I get a wider variety of human being in a college classroom than I ever got in a church.
Mm-hmm.
With the exception of socioeconomics, you know, we'll get a few Rotary scholarships and people who couldn't afford to be in school under any circumstances. But at least culturally, wow, do I get a cross-section that I would never have gotten in a church youth group, for instance. But I think I've strayed from your question, which is I need to find situations in which I am participating apart from my professional role in life. And that's not easy to do if you've got a high-profile job.
Yeah. Do you think it would be bad for the church if the person in that role tried to experience that type of transformation within their own community?
Oh, good luck with that. No, I don't think, you know, no. Again, that's an excellent question that I'd need a lot more time to think through. But the peace I have made with that in my own life is when I accepted a job as pastor of a congregation, my job was to participate in the formation of faith, the formation and continuation of faith in people. My job wasn't to stir things up. You know, I mean, the gospel could stir things up, and there could be study groups in the church or mission groups in the church whose business was to stir things up. But I never really thought my job was to stand up there and break new ground and offer startling insights, you know, or or be Martin Luther. I mean, but I don't. But again, I've only been in two churches. There are clergy and churches that count on them to do that. So.
So you think that is a role that some pastors, priests, where it just wasn't yours in the two that you have, you know, been in, right?
Yeah, and I mean, one unusual thing about my job now is I get to travel a lot. So I go to churches whose reputation is to be dismantlers. You know, their reputation is to go against the cultural grain of the community in which they're planted. So I've certainly visited those churches as well. I just never spent any concentrated time in them. So, you know, you talk to Becca Stevens in Nashville. She's somebody who's interesting to me now. She's not in a parish ministry. Well, she is, but her parish is Thistle Farms, right? Are you aware of her?
No, I feel like I need to get to know her, though.
Yeah, you know, she'd be a wonderful guest on your show. Becca Stevens, an Episcopal priest in Nashville. That's all you need to look her up. But, that's a really interesting way in which she's living out her priestly identity, her pastoral vocation. In terms of, she works with women who have come out of sex trade and was participating in their rebirth, their renewal, their rediscovery of what else they might be up to in their lives.
Yeah, that's good. Now, your writing does plenty of dismantling because, for example, you make the line, or you say the line, that there is no filling a hole that was never designed to be filled, only to be entered into. Now, for many years, we've heard that there's a God-shaped hole in all of us that God can fill, and we can get rid of that. You probably heard of, Bertram Berry's daughter who talks about there was this hole of God-shaped hole that never got filled in his life, and that's, you know, where some of his work came out of. And there's even a Christian song that says there's a God-shaped hole in all of us that was in that Jim Carrey movie. And so we've been told all of a sudden, like, if you have enough God, then this hole inside of your heart can be filled. But you say it can't, that we just need to be entered in, we just need to enter into it.
What God, that was, that other thing is kind of like a catch-22, isn't it? There's a hole that can't be filled, but if you'll fill it, it will be filled. I mean,
that didn't make sense.
There was a logical inconsistency in there somewhere. You know, the image that helps me with that is the Holy of Holies in the temple in Jerusalem, the old temple in Jerusalem, which exists only in my imagination and the Talmudic imagination. And who is the... There was some Roman conqueror, right, who burst in there, sure it was going to be full of gold and treasure and jewels, and burst into the Holy of Holies and found it was an empty room.
Yeah.
And now I get my memory confused with Steven Spielberg and, you know, the seraphim and cherubim. But I love the idea that the holiest space in me and in the temple that is me or the temple that is us is an empty space. And what that means is there's just all kinds of room to move around and lie down on the ground and be quiet together and breathe into being lonely sometimes. And that's a comforting. Seems to be, I just X'd it out. That's a comforting image to me.
That's a, okay. So, but what's comforting to me is like there is this divine blanket that can wrap me up and keep me warm all night. That's like comforting, but this is, it's comforting that it's, that there's always going to be this hole that it can't be filled, that we just enter into this seemingly abyss, right?
Oh, what abyss. That's your word.
I know. I'm just.
A quiet room. A quiet place. Well, here's the catch, okay? Have you ever found the blanket that always keeps you warm?
I had an electric one time, and then it broke.
Yeah, see?
So is that your point proven?
The answer is no, right, Luke? The answer is no, you haven't. And I think what is so unhappy-making for some of us is we've always been told that if we just hold our mouths right or show up at the right place at the right time, that we'll be happy forever.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not true. So what is much more happy-making is to hear that God is not in the business of wrapping me up in a warm blanket so I'll always be happy. That was never God's interest. And that's liberating. Oh, that's not what God had in store for me? Well, what else might be out there for me? And in some ways it's absurd we're having this conversation if Jesus is in any way an exemplar for either of us, because that guy, you know,
yeah,
he never even had a place to plug an electric blanket in.
No,
so.
He didn't. He was really shortchanged in that sense. That was terrible. Okay, so to steal a line from my next guest, Philip Yancey, so there's this like disappointment with God. That do you think that's because people have kind of overpromised what God is supposed to do for them, and then life does not let that be their experience?
See, I've never been, to my knowledge, disappointed with God. I've been disappointed with the spokespersons for God.
Well, you can differentiate those two. Not everyone can differentiate the spokeswoman or man and God.
Uh-huh. Well, then they need to grow up.
I like that pastoral advice from Barbara Brown Taylor. You need to grow up. That's great.
I mean, even Paul says there's a time to put the bottle down, right?
Yeah, yeah. But we all, like, experience heartbreak with church, and whether it's you know, the spokesperson who speaks out of turn, or like as a pastor, like the when people leave, like that breaks your heart. And you've written before about how when people pull away from church when they're going through adversity, whether it's, you know, they're having an addiction or job loss or, you know, mental illness or something, they pull away. That's discouraging for you, right? And so, yeah. And so, like, how do we separate that from, okay, we're disappointed with the people in church, but not church and God in general?
Okay, first of all, we're way out there in our general area again, right? So we got to know which person's pulling away, why, under what circumstances. And I'm such a good news junkie. Here's what I've noticed happens. Sometimes what happens to people during that time is they leave forever and they decide they're not people of faith after all.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes what happens is one or two people come after them, or one or two people who have nothing to do with their churches find them, and they discover salvation in places they never expected. And then there's another group who use that experience to realize how many pacifiers they were sucking on that were keeping them from encountering the places they most needed to go. So I've just seen that one work out so many different ways, from tragedy to salvation to almost comedy, that I want to agree with you that it's heartbreaking, but that may be the view from the very center of the church community. And I think sometimes if you track the people who've left, it's not all awful.
Yeah.
It can be.
Well, you know,
I've
seen this in the last handful of years, that couples pull away from church, and then you find out on more than one occasion these couples are going through divorces. And they're at the beginning process, and they're going to get a divorce. And I don't know exactly what the deal is. Maybe it's the embarrassment or the shame where they have to tell everyone, yes, you know, our marriage, you know, fell apart and we're not going to be together anymore. And so they don't want to be around the community for that. And that is, you know, disappointing, because we can't be there for them like we want to be. We can't be the friends for them that we would like to be as a church. But then you described like an idea, okay, well, maybe we're moving away and maybe they find salvation, they find grace somewhere else individually or together. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I don't know how a whole church could be there for me when I'm divorced, especially if I'm divorcing somebody who's also a member of the parish. I mean, people are going to choose.
Yeah,
they're going to join the jury. And so I don't know how a whole church can be there for me when I'm divorcing. I know people in the church who can be there for me when I'm divorcing and who continue to be. But I don't know how the whole church can be.
So we need to be okay with, okay, they're not showing up, they're not, you know, eating meals with us anymore, they're not breaking the bread together with us, but there are a few of us who can still reach out, and that's, you know, that's okay?
Yeah, I mean, I'll give you another crazy poll to this. Okay. I had a friend who was a minister in another denomination, but when his wife died way too soon, he started going to the 8 o'clock church at the 8 o'clock service at the Episcopal Church. And when I asked him why he had left his own community, who knew him and had cared for him and his wife, why he went to the 8 o'clock across town, he said, because nobody will touch me there, and I need not to be touched right now. I need to go into that place and let that liturgy rock me, and I don't want people touching me right now. And I thought, wow, it really shifted my notion of what some people need that's so counter to what I would have offered. That's just one person, but that's all we're talking about, I think. And please, I'm just being a contrarian. I completely understand what you say, and I've even, you know, I've written about it way more than once, about how sad it is that whatever kind of image we put up in church about the way you must be in order to be easily here is one that doesn't allow much brokenness. And our joke, you know, is go to the AA meeting downstairs. The 12-step groups are the place that have somehow institutionalized around a different way of being, haven't they? Because, you know, I'd like to say institutional church just can't do all the things you and I are talking about, but the truth is 12-step programs have institutionalized their care in a different way that somehow allows for more brokenness. So there, you know, there's plenty to read and talk about on that subject.
Have you been involved with the 12-step? Have you gotten to know people who are in it or who lead it or anything like that?
Students have been my way in. I get invited to birthday parties from time to time. And I've often been interested in simply going, but I am not sure how to ask somebody. I haven't wanted to be a voyeur, you know?
Yeah, that's fair enough. Fair enough.
But I read plenty of 12-step books. I mean, I'm just too whatever to show up without an active addiction. I'm ready to stand up and talk about it. And I'm not talking about my Neiman Marcus charge card. Not talking about it.
There are other ways you can get addictions very easily. You can make a trip to Vegas and probably get one in a weekend.
Thank you. Okay, thanks. I go to Gamblers Anonymous. That'll work.
I'm trying to just give you some options out here, so that's good.
Okay, thank you.
Now, you've got this line that I've never got to ask you about before, but the what's saving your life right now? Okay, so that could have been your shtick when you went to Oprah. You could have said, you know, this is what I sell. This is my line, the what's saving you right now. Have you ever, you could have led with that. So, like, talk to me a little bit about, like, where that line came from and how that became a big part of kind of the Barbara Brown Taylor experience.
Oh, I got that one from John Claypool when he was rector of an Episcopal church in Birmingham, and he invited me to come speak to St. Stephen's. And, no, is it St. Stephen's? St. Matthew's? St. Luke's. It was St. Luke's, Birmingham.
Yeah, let's go with
St. Luke's. I knew I did it eventually. Yeah. St. Luke's, Birmingham. And he asked me to come speak, and I said, what do I talk about? And he said, just come tell us what's saving your life now. Hmm. And I had never heard an invitation like that. So I've never gotten it out of my mind. What I love about it is no two people answer that the same way. And the minute they begin to answer it, ask that way, you find out that what saves people's lives are their grandchildren, or they just started working out at a gym, or it's a new place they have found to go on weekends off. I mean, you find out it's none of the official religious stuff that's saving their life now. And so it frees, I don't know, it's just a real breath of fresh air question to ask people. And also most people are taken aback. Some of us have to be asked twice because the first thing we'll say is my new Toyota Prius. And then the person looks at you and says, no, what's really saving your life?
Yeah.
And then you have to go down a layer further. You may even have to be asked three times. But I think most of us can talk about that.
Why do you think many of us need to be asked the question a second and a third time to get to the real answer?
Well, I don't know about you, but I sometimes would like to be saved at shallower levels instead of deeper ones. So to be saved at a shallow level is to, you know, pull off a great dinner. I don't know. I mean, I'm making this up now, but I have shallower answers and I have deeper answers. And depending on who's asking me, I'll choose the one that gives me the degree of closeness I want. So there are blithe answers, there are shallow answers, there are deeper answers.
And you think that's just a normal way that, you know, we interact, and we don't want to, you know, play our cards too soon, or we don't want to, like, emotionally vomit on someone inappropriately, right?
Yeah. Well, and again, how many people have really thought about that? And you know, I like the word saving instead of salvation because it bumps it off center a little bit, but that's here's another way to ask it that works really well, which is, what do you know gives you life that you never seem to find time to do?
Mm-hmm.
What do you know gives you life that you almost never take time to do? That's one that can reduce people to tears, I think. And if it's a quiet enough room, if it's an empty enough room, but it gets at the same thing. I think sometimes those of us who are Christians can get so focused on loving God and loving Jesus and our neighbor as ourselves that we forget to ask about what gives life, what gives abundant life, what really gives us life. Because if it gives us life, it's going to give life to the people we love also, I think.
Well, why did you want to get off the word salvation to saving? Tell me more about the benefit of getting off that word.
Oh, I'm just at a different, I mean, for years and years I defended the traditional language of faith, like Will Willimon and Stanley Hauerwas. You know, I said, if you want to be a psychologist, you got to learn the psychological language. If you want to be a Christian, you got to learn the Christian language. You have to learn the words.
Yeah.
And I'm not, probably teaching college now, that has not been as helpful. first of all, because we all think we mean the same thing when we say God, and we don't at all, not till somebody asks us what we mean when we say God. So the language itself seems much more porous to me than it ever did. And then it's such off-putting language to so many people who are sure they know what we, what they're so sure they think they know what we mean when we're saying it, that there's just like nine levels of James Bond deception going on there. So just lately, it's been more interesting to me to think about the realities those words name. And that's a much more interesting conversation with people. What do you mean when you say salvation? What do you mean when you say sin? Mm-hmm. What do you mean when you say heaven? So, what do you mean when you say grace? What do you mean when you say mercy?
Would you say your definition of some of the those words have evolved over the last few years or last decades?
They've proliferated. They're embodied. And they have as many bodies as the people who've told me stories about what they mean. So they are words that have been poured into so many bodies that I have a hard time now making them sit up straight and get back into the dictionary.
No, that's good. Can you give me an example of one that's maybe morphed the most or proliferated the most? That's a great word, by the way. Proliferate. Yeah. Give me an example.
Well, sin is a troublesome one to so many people. You know, I just had a visitor to World Religions class, and he comes from the Vedanta Center of Atlanta, which means he comes out of, continental Indian philosophy. But sin, I think, I'm not going to take this away from anybody. For anybody who needs to believe that they are innately corrupt and that helps them make sense of their lives, I want them to have that and ride that horse until they don't want to ride that horse anymore. But I have found with most people I know right now that it is so much more life-giving to think of sin as missing the mark, the good old Greek translation. I aimed, I missed, damn it. I'm going to aim again.
Yeah, try it again.
Missed again. Okay, now I'm going to go join an archery club. You know, but it's like missing the mark is so much less self-defeating than I am incapable of hitting the target.
Hmm. Why do you think that? Why is it so less? Why is it so destructive?
I should only say destructive to me because again I know people for whom that makes incredible sense. Mm-hmm. Now I've heard Nadja Boltz-Weber talk about sin and corruption, and I mean she's a Lutheran and she can talk about that stuff in incredibly touching, meaningful ways, mm-hmm. and speak to people who know what she is talking about. Because I have been shaped by Anglican tradition, I think I come out of a tradition that wants to talk about what Matthew Fox once named original blessing. And there are as many problems with that as there are with original sin. In my mind, it's just where you're going to start. You know, what's the core substance, and then what's the overlay that needs some scraping away? Yeah. And I just would rather throw my line in with the original goodness. God made us good. God made us in God's image and called us good. And then there were problems. Instead of, I am innately fallen, and I have to exert incredible numbers of calories to do anything good.
Yeah. Oh, that's good news. That's great. Barbara, thank you so much for your time. I know you're working on this the book for Time. Answering the anxiety question. But I've got an idea. You become friends with Oprah, right? You're friends with her as of August. Have you thought about trying to get Leaving Church, and maybe accumulation of a couple of your pieces, and turn them into a movie and get Oprah to produce it? I think that'd be a great idea.
You know, Luke, I never talk to you that I don't come away with the idea for something new to do. So
yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Luke.
Hey, I don't have to be an executive producer on the project, but at least put me somewhere on the credits. So if you're gonna do the movie, have you thought about who you would have play Barbara Brown Taylor?
No, I haven't gotten that far. Come on, nominate somebody. I secretly want you to say Diane Keaton, okay?
Diane Keaton, that's who I was going to say.
Yeah, that's right, who you were going to say.
There's no way in the world I was going to answer that question for you. That
I know, because you would have gotten in serious, deep trouble. But, yeah, I think Diane Keaton, she's just anxious enough. It might work.
Okay, well, I will see if I can get her email address and start talking to her for you, okay?
I appreciate it. Thanks for the time.
Hey, can I tell you the nicest thing I've heard all month? I was talking to our friend Suzanne from Harper One.
Yeah.
I was interviewing Rob Bell a couple weeks ago, and I was talking to her before the interview. And I told her I was talking with you in a couple weeks. She said, wow, Barbara doesn't like to do media. And so for her to come back on your show, that means a lot. Well, first of all, I don't think I'm media. I think I'm just a fan with a microphone. But the fact that you'd come back on the show makes me very warm in my heart. So thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thanks for the good work you did.
Thanks for checking out Newsworthy with Norsworthy. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You are now adjourned.